This program was written, narrated, and produced by Askia Muhammad, who is solely responsible for its content.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. For a copy of this program or programs in this series, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us toll-free in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres with support from the Pacifica Radio Archives staff. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, funded in part from Pacifica Station listeners like you. Current preservation projects are funded in part by grants from the Grammy Foundation and the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more, please visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radio Land. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani! Boing, boing.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31, 2021, at PCC's Cascade Campus Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Talk and Taste, Getting Vaccinated for the Love of Health, hosted by Preserve Coalition. On Wednesday, February 10th, from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m., streaming online. Talk and Taste is a virtual afternoon of engaging activities, cooking demonstrations, informative talks, and dance and exercise lessons hosted by LaTroy Robinson. Again, that's Talk and Taste, Getting Vaccinated for the Love of Health, hosted by Preserve Coalition, on Wednesday, February 10th, from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland. Now stay tuned for Fortress on a Hill.
Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to Americans.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists when nothing could be more false.
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that.
Okay, welcome listeners to Fortress on a Hill. We decided that it was really important that we take this moment. Oddly enough, that just a few hours ago, Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. So we wanted to take today to talk about our predictions and possibilities for 2021. So we're going to take a jaunt around the globe to a bunch of different regions, and we're going to pepper Danny, because we never do that. We never rely on Danny for his expertise. Danny has a really great Tom Dispatch piece coming out on this topic. It actually comes out tomorrow. And we're going to do a, I'm going to do a super fast turnaround with editing and stuff. So this episode should be available for all of you to hear tomorrow, the 21st of January. And as you're listening today, if you see any, you know, if you see anything that we missed or that needs to be pointed out more, please let us know. Tell us what your thoughts and predictions are for this year. We absolutely want to hear them. Danny, do you want to take a minute and talk a little bit about your piece?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Tom Dispatch is, of course, we've had Tom on, and we've actually had a number of different Tom Dispatch regulars on, like Bill Astori writes over there. Andrew Basevich, we haven't had, but he writes over there. And, you know, Eric Edstrom has, but Rebecca Gordon, of course. When you do an article for Tom, I mean, it's a different kind of place. It gets like a pretty decent amount of syndication in the mid and upper mid media, including some worldwide stuff. And Tom is different also in that he likes long form pieces that are like 2,500 words. And he's kind of a brutal editor in like the old school fashion. But he also kind of helps pick a topic with you. You know, you have like, and he's old school, right? He's like 74 years old, and he like does things like the old correct way, sort of. And so you talk on the phone and you go back and forth and you brainstorm. So when he said he wanted me to do one of the early, you know, articles, something that was going to be timed on the inauguration, essentially, you know, he said, how about, you know, something that relates to what we can expect from Biden? And I had actually been working on, and I'm still working on, like a broader piece on basically an around the globe flyover of like every region and making predictions a bit for what might happen there. Because I've been right a lot recently, but that's disturbing. Like, I'm not as vindicated by that as I want, like whether it was Nagorno-Karabakh or certain Biden picks. And now it seems my stuff on West Africa, you know, I've been right a bunch, and don't worry, it won't hold. And if it does, we're going extinct as a species. So like, root against me, guys. I'm like Pete Rose. I'm gonna be like voting. I'm gonna be like betting against my own team because that's best for everyone. But he said, okay, well, like, I don't know that I want you to do that specifically, but let's talk, you know, what's Biden gonna do in some key regions? And that's kind of what the piece does. It doesn't hit everywhere, but it hits the general highlights, mostly regional and then just a little bit thematic.
All right. So first up, we're going to go take a quick jaunt through the greater Middle East, talk about Afghanistan, Iraq, certainly Syria, and Yemen. For my part, I was making some notes this morning about pretty much all those places, but more specifically Yemen, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So right now in Afghanistan, Trump has us down to 2,500 troops, and there is a deal coming to remove all U.S. troops in the next few months that was signed. There's still about 18,000 contractors that are there for those 2,500 troops, although about 4,700 of those are local Afghans. And my guess, my thought about it is that the drawdown is going to probably get reversed. Which is a shame, because it's certainly been one of Trump's better calls on the foreign policy stage to attempt to bring troops down there. It was even got so serious last summer that the Congress withheld funds specifically for Trump to not withdraw the troops, actually took the money away that could have potentially made that happen. So, Danny, what do you think Biden will do with this, especially considering that there is an actual peace deal that has been agreed upon and that there's an actual timetable for that deal?
Yeah, you know, Afghanistan specifically, I'm of two minds about, and I'll get that in a second. I think that a good general prediction that I've, you know, been saying for a while in a bunch of places is that I don't think that we're going to see Biden do, you know, Iraq war, whatever it would be by this point, 3 or 4.0. I don't think we're going to see like a big invasion followed by catastrophic sectarian civil war set off by our own troops, at least proxies, maybe. I think partly mainly because there's no political will for it. And Biden, if nothing else, has shown himself to be the type that is malleable and kind of shifts with the prevailing political winds, which we've talked about when we talked about his general foreign policy. But also, I think I like to believe he kind of has learned something, you know, from the Bush years of like the post 9/11 era. So I think in general, we're going to see is like a lot of the same, like a very low intensity war as abstraction. This will be across the greater Middle East and Africa. You know, this general use of proxies, contractors, drones, commando raids, and like security force assistance, you know, like that's how we're going to fight the war. It'll be low intensity for America, not always low intensity for its victims and its second and third order consequences. Now, Afghanistan is just, I'm very much of two minds about it, because Biden was basically the best in the senior levels of the Obama administration when he was vice president on Afghanistan. You know, I've mentioned before that it's in Richard Holbrooke's, you know, death diary, you know, I mean, that they had a conversation where Biden like snapped at him and is like, it won't work. Like, we're not gonna be able to transform the society. I'm not sending my son 10,000 miles around the world to go back there. Of course, he hadn't been in Afghanistan, he'd been in Iraq, but you know, back to these wars, back to the war in Afghanistan specifically to, you know, fight for women's rights. It won't work. It won't work, he said. And he was a critic of it. I mean, and in general, he's been more of the, hey, let's do counter terror rather than counterinsurgency, you know, lower impact on America. That being said, everything that we're hearing from like the Jake Sullivans, his incoming national security advisor of the world, everything that's in their past record, and everything that we have seen in Biden's record, which is like a classic hedging. You know, I think that's what I said at the end of the piece was like, when it comes to Afghanistan, you know, because Trump didn't pull enough troops out faintly fast enough, thereby making the withdrawal maybe irreversible, expect a trademark Biden hedge here. And I think that that's true in a lot of places, but it's particularly true in Afghanistan. So a lot of the statements from Jake Sullivan stuff is like, we won't have any more combat troops or American troops in combat or in harm's way, but not the statement of everyone will be gone by X date. I don't think we'll see any of that. There could be a reversal. It could jump from 2,500 back to 4,000 or something like that. We could even see like a mini surge of like logistics, special forces, and, you know, air power if the Taliban starts to gain ground. My last point on this that worries me, two last points. One, the Democratic Party. I'm afraid of the Democratic Party more than I'm specifically afraid of Joe Biden on this issue, because I really do think that he was almost like a consensus collection of like smoke-filled rooms, like backroom insiders in the DNC. Like, and I don't know, you know, presidents have a lot of unilateral power, but he's going to feel pressure from his own party. And they've kind of followed the whole, if Trump did it, we have to do the opposite, which of course they learned from Trump, who did that about Obama. If Obama was for it, I'm against it, and vice versa. So voting against, you know, the appropriations needed to pull the troops is a worrying signal. Now, one would hope that when Biden's in charge, troop withdrawals could be celebrated by the same Democrats, because most of them don't really believe in anything, right? Let's be clear. And that's, you know, I'm not even talking about the Republicans, because, you know, they're dead to me. But this is, I think, especially after, you know, only 10 of them voted for impeachment or whatever in the House. But that worries me. And then the final bit is, There are interested parties at think tanks funded by the war industry, at places like West Point's Combating Terrorism Center, at other, you know, kind of defense analyst organizations like RAND. You're seeing a lot of alarmism come back, and I'll get to it in Africa later. You're seeing it in Afghanistan too. All this reporting saying, oh, there's a renewed connection between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and they're going to bring back the safe haven myth, this idea that, you know, terrorism is way worse if they have like a safe haven that they can kind of stay in a cave or whatever. Of course, that's all been like deflated time and again. But I'm afraid that he'll be susceptible to that kind of logic and will be afraid that if he pulls everybody out, and then something does go wrong and there is an attack or whatever in America, or if something obscene happens, like some sort of mass beheading of like adulterous women, alleged adulterous women in a stadium again in Afghanistan, that he'll be criticized as cutting and running. So that's why I expect a hedge. And it worries me because, you know, if Biden doesn't pull them out during his tenure, we are actually, and realistically this could happen, staring down the barrel of, you know, 24 years of Afghan war. I mean, that's beyond absurd.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. So let's move on to Iraq for a minute. We are about just over a year from the most recent major demonstrations in Iraq, also just right around a year from the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, which was a big blow to our connections, not only with Iran, but with Iraq. Going back to the protests for a moment, you know, the Iraqis protesting corruption in their government, violence against protesters, low wages, basic services from the government. And then you have a country that, moving back from the protests a little bit, that has been absolutely destroyed by ISIS, by their invasion of it, that, you know, places like Mosul in the north and Anbar province in the west, basically, I mean, they exist, but they're rubble with bodies everywhere. And, you know, the ISIS invasion was preempted by America's own withdrawal of a majority of their forces, and they only ended up that the majority of forces that guys like me and also like BT trained ran. They sold their weapons or left them behind for other parties to do with as they seemed. But now that ISIS has been pushed down significantly, it's important to note that Iraqis did most of the heavy lifting during that time. But in country, there are still more than 1 million unsettled refugees, people who cannot return to their homes, probably because they're completely bombed out. Of course, they're dealing with COVID, which is hard for any country to deal with, but especially hard because of our sanctions and destroyed infrastructure. So, you know, my only thought about it in terms of moving forward, you know, I think that Iraq should be given all the money and supplies it needs to rebuild their country. But as America, our country has never made that a priority. My guess is that Biden will help that situation more than Trump, but much like you mentioned, Danny, about him hedging, I don't expect much more than beyond that, that the billions and billions that should go to a country that our military destroyed probably won't get the help that they need.
You know, when the Iraq Veterans Against the War were founded, in what, 2004, you know, I was talking to Kelly Daugherty recently, who was one of the co-founders, and, you know, one of their original platforms was, you know, not just like troops home, but reparations for the Iraqi people, you know? I mean, that look, no one's even considering reparations for chattel slavery in the United States, right? And then like, you know, the century of Jim Crow and then de facto Jim Crow that goes on today. Certainly there's no talk of reparations for Iraq. What we see instead is this just like a continued infusion of defense money, right? Of military money, of military training and weapons and these sorts of things. My take on Iraq, okay, what worries me about Iraq is Iraq
matters because humans live there and because it's an important country. But from an American strategic perspective and what concerns me in terms of the decisions that are being made, okay, and I don't mean sound obtuse, I will say this. Iraq doesn't matter that much any longer, except insofar as it worsens, it only stands to worsen our relations with Iran and the possibility of a war there. What you have in Iraq is American soldiers who literally do not know what they're doing there, right? Could an American soldier really explain what their purpose is in Iraq, right? They say it's like Syria. They say it originally, well, we're here to fight ISIS as part of the ISIS coalition. But if you actually listen to what the generals and the analysts and the national security officials on the civilian side say, it's always the same thing. It's like, no, we're actually here to balance Russia and Iran in Syria and Iran in Iraq. We're there as part of a proxy war, and we've made ourselves our own proxies in our own proxy war, and we've thrown these guys into these bases and turned them into rocket magnets for vaguely Iranian-inflected and sometimes more so Iraqi militias to shoot rockets at whenever we do something new and aggressive and obscene at Iran, or whenever Iran needs to shore up its hardliner credentials with, you know, certain elements of their public, especially when their economy is flailing and they're doing bad with COVID, right? And so they're there, they're magnets, they're rocket magnets. And the problem is the toughness dilemma, the Democrats' dilemma of toughness. They must always, they feel, seem extra tough because they're afraid the Republicans will swift vote them. And I say this all the time, right? John Kerry, when they swift voted and tried to say he was like a coward and he wasn't a good soldier, even though he was like highly decorated as a Navy swift boat captain. So, but they're going to swift boat you anyway, the Republicans. But they're so afraid of it that we like hedge and we always tack right and they always move the goalposts, the Republicans do. So I'm afraid that if Americans die under Biden's watch in Iraq, in one of these, you know, barrages of missiles, like if an unlucky hit hits an unlucky soldier who chose the unlucky porta potty, and it's funny, but it's not, because it really happens, as you know, as we know, that Biden will feel obliged to respond to Iran. So, you know, I cannot see a situation where, you know, our presence in Iraq is anything but destabilizing and anything but increasing the likelihood that a more dangerous conflict with Iran, whether it be proxy or in some cases genuine, like bombing or then Iran unleashing some of its folks on us across the region, right? Because we have lots of targets in the Middle East, including floating targets. That all worries me. And so I'm afraid that in the process of hedging, he's going to actually set a trap for himself. And it's a trap that was that Trump bequeathed him, not literally, because Trump's not dead, you know. And I'm not even going to say what I'm thinking about that. But you know, I think that, you know, this trap was left for him. I'm afraid he's going to keep the American military in the jaws, right, ready for that bear trap to potentially close, and then is going to feel obliged to respond, which could cause an escalation and more troops there. And you know, the whole thing is just a big mess. There is nothing rational about the American presence in Iraq, and of course there never really was, but it's even more absurd today.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
Right. I think about that a lot, about like I have to think that there are people who get that, right? That are in positions and they understand, like, hey, us being there leads to the potential of escalation, which only makes things worse. And there has to be some people in some of the apparatus who are willing to push back against that. Now, what I want to know is why, like, who are the people that are pushing back against this narrative and who want us to continue this, and why? And like, I feel like if we were able to get that message out to more folks as to understanding why, I think more people would be on the side of, okay, it's time for us to leave. But we never get that side from the official state apparatus, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, one thing I'll just add to that is that most of the people he picked, as much as I've like attacked I mean, really lambasted his picks, like every one. I mean, I've really made a career of it of like for 2 months. But as bad as they are in terms of their military-industrial complex ties and their record as arsonists put in charge of the fire brigade on things like Syria, Libya, Yemen, I mean, every one of them, including now, finally, Joe Biden, these guys aren't bullish on the Iraq war. Every right. single one of these men and women would tell an interviewer and have that the Iraq invasion of 2003 was one of the great foreign policy disasters of American policy. That's the difference of when you get, and it's a real difference. I mean, it's not just at the margins. I mean, compared to, you know, some of the neocon like hawks that are in the Republican Party, you know, when you put the Democrats in charge, that the at least they're going to say Iraq was bad, even if they supported it at the time. But that is an irony, isn't it? That, you know, you've got these people in there who every one of them thinks the Iraq war was a mistake, but I'm not sure that any of the senior people, I can't speak to their mid-level staff, but I don't see any one of the senior people that he's appointed to the national security establishment who would then go so far as to say Iraq is the greatest strategic disaster, you know, in modern American history, but dot, 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 we kind of have to stay because ISIS, Iran, I don't know. We don't want to look weak, do we? I mean, that's how American policy is made. That's the philosophy.
Right. Ugh. That's just depressing. It's just so, it's so cowardly to just sit there and say, we know there's a problem, but we're not going to do anything about it because we don't want to appear a certain way. And I know that's all politics, but like, these are like millions of people's lives at, on the line. And I would add, you know, you mentioned all the issues with it, but also like just the fact that like Iraq is important because if it's destabilized, like it's only going to worsen in the rest of the region. It's only going to make all the other problems in the whole region worse. And if we do nothing or we keep going along this weird path of like exiting American military presence and pushing the contractor, pushing the JSOC, pushing the more, you know, proxy forces, like we're, it's not, it's just going to lead us to have less and less ability to do anything about it concretely.
Well, Henry, you were involved in, you know, the more overt version of the, you know, kind of security force assistance, training proxies, you know, when it was pretty overt. I mean by that, you know, when it was like direct tactical army units, especially MPs like yourself, you know, training the official army we were raising in Iraq. You know, how did that experience, I guess, you know, influence the way you think about whether or not, you know, training, advising, and assisting foreign forces constitutes, you know, combat or an intervention? Because you'll see, I think what you're going to see when it comes to Iraq and lots of other things is you'll see the Biden administration re-inject the quibbling language of the Obama years, where everyone was arguing the semantics of what constitutes a boot on the ground and right. what constitutes a combat soldier, which, like, I love language and therefore I like to look to it. But I mean, that got pretty absurdist. And the Republicans weren't wrong when they started pointing that out. I mean, they were wrong because like everything that was in their hearts was black mostly and horrifying, but they weren't wrong. And I'm afraid we're gonna go back to that. So I guess, Henry, what did your experience doing that influence the way you view this kind of stuff?
It does in a few different ways. There was always such a learning curve to everything that we did, and on learning curve, I'm not just talking about the Iraqis that we tried to train, but for us too, in terms of, you know, you bring with you, you know, just the platoon or squad, whatever you happen to have, and whatever training they have is what training they have, and it doesn't allow for, you know, the two or three guys possibly in your squad or platoon that absolutely hate Iraqis because they're on their second or third tour. So trying to train them in any kind of a comprehensive, unnerving way is just completely difficult. But the thing that I look back to, the thing that is most, one of the things that is most powerful to me, aside from stories like hearing about the Iraqi, you know, battalions, them, their battalions and divisions folding before they even got into contact with ISIS. It's about that we don't understand, we don't even have enough understanding to understand the economics of bringing the equipment that we gave to the Iraqis, where, like, you know, and I've mentioned this quite a few times on the podcast, but, you know, Iraqi police recruits or officers, however you want to coin them, there often wasn't very much of a difference. The guys would go sell their Glock. They got issued a brand new Glock 19 pistol, you know, for police work, and they would go and sell it in the market. Why? Because they were super evil? No, it was because it was worth so much more than they had ever made over the course of 6 months or a year of wages, if not even longer. That was one of the big things that the protests, the ongoing protests are about, is the low wages or late wages, wages that are paid, you know, 9 months or 12 months later. And so it really required a lot of effort to take a specific amount of recruits and actually turn them into something that an American police officer would say, this person has some skills. You know, I don't understand Arabic or anything, but they know how to handcuff somebody and they know how to do this and do that. But as with our military machine, as each new unit would come and take over the jobs that I had there, everybody has a different idea of what is the best way to do it. Aside from the very basics, you know, the very basics in terms of using hand signals to do that kind of thing, we didn't have anything else to use to get across what was happening. But I think that we didn't even understand what it was doing to the local economics, to the local social and political scene. I remember being just freaking flabbergasted being told that a local prison that was near some of my operations area was entirely corrupt. It's like the entire working staff of this prison is corrupt. If you want somebody out, even if their sentence had already ended, they probably had to pay a bunch of money. And that was something that we never understood while we were there. We knew that there was quote-unquote corruption, but we didn't understand what we were looking at in the first place, and we didn't have any resources to fight that corruption either. Because how do you do it when it's a somewhat working part of a place's culture? But no, it was at the end of the day, it was entirely for naught. You know, I don't think that we left much of an appreciable anything in terms of police force or army force that the Iraqis could use, that they could count on, which is why, you know, that the Kurds coming south to help, and the fact that they actually expelled ISIS. I mean, ISIS isn't completely gone, but the fact that the Iraqis themselves did it mostly without American support, aside from some air support, I think that that's an impressive and huge thing. But it's out of survival. It's not because we did anything, we left anything there that was going to help the Iraqis in a major way.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
Now, I think that what's interesting about what you're saying there, and it relates to Africa a bit, and so, and we can pivot to that if you guys want, or we could hold it. But I'll say, like, what you raised there is a bit of nuance and complexity that's just so often missing in the discussions of this, because the host government and the political, ethnic, sociocultural, and, you know, just general value and legitimacy of the host government and its military matters a whole lot in a security force assistance mission. And so, you know, I've been writing, for example, about Africa again recently, because you know how I do. And, like, it's, I think, pretty important, because one of the things I said in this last article was, you know, I titled it, this is at antiwar.com, ISIS Africa Alarmism, brought to you context free by defense analysts. And what I say, the context that's missing, I say, you know, that these people, these analysts, are interested in attack numbers and statistics, sure, but, and then I write, conflict context, local grievances and catalyzers, the counterproductivity of past Western military interventions, and then this is the key, or the tainted and dubiously legitimate regimes they usually back, not so much. And so, you know, the Iraqi military, you know, did do the lion's share of the fighting and put itself together, but they, of course, did fall apart, you know, when ISIS first comes through. But before that, and you probably remember this, I mean, units that we worked with and that we were, you know, whatever, advising and definitely partnering, that was the big term back then, right? Put an Iraqi between you and the problem. I was like, that's so patronizing, I don't even know what to do with it, but okay. And it was a great buzzword, but what was interesting about it was they were torturing prisoners. You know, my colonel sent a special patrol to seize the prisoners that we had earlier in the day handed over to the Iraqi National Police to save them from the torture that we got a tip that they were undergoing, and they were. And so it's just like we throw military solutions and we throw things like advising and assisting and training and arming at these problems as though they're in as though they're solves, right? They're solutions in and of themselves. We pay very little attention to the host government. So you get the Maliki regime. One of the reasons that they fall apart in Mosul is Maliki had removed some of the most competent generals and officers and replaced them with, you know, political partisan loyalists from his own faction of the Shia faction, right? The faction within the faction. And then these were political generals and they had ghost soldiers on their roles and all this and corrupt. And I don't know, it just seems like we miss all of that. So when they throw a bunch of drone contractor commandos, advise and assist, special operators, they just throw it at the wall and see what sticks. And it's all done like an absence of context and without understanding that the well is poisoned from the start if you're doing it with corrupt proxies. And that just always just jumps out at me. And Africa, of course, is like the key element where I think we're seeing some of this.
Yeah. There was never any training or even acknowledgement of the idea that here we are arriving to a country that is, you know, is 30 to 40 years deep, if we can go back further historically, but that the 30 to 40 years deep in the choices and draconian measures of our imperialism there, which even if there were, you know, IPs that wanted to do a good job, that wanted to be part of it, I wouldn't blame any of them for having a natural distrust of anything that we did, because it could just immediately be turned around so easily, and they had so little control over what that happened. You know, that changing out a commander, changing out a unit, going from army soldiers to Marines or back again, you know, coalition forces, meaning that sometimes Poland or some other countries might have some little small sector. There's so many irons in the fire. You have to pick one and completely detangle it before you can get to the next. And it just became that you know, we're picking back up the latest mess up, the latest fuck up, and we're going to work on that for a while, but it doesn't change anything. And that was where I was when I was on my second tour in Iraq, is that I knew we weren't changing anything. I knew we weren't going to substantially help the people of Iraq in some measurable way. I just wanted everybody to make home alive on both ends. And, you know, I didn't want to hurt anybody, and I didn't want any of our guys to get hurt. Those were the only things, only metrics that I could discernibly have any kind of control in. And that's immediately where I went to. So, Danny, if you want, we can go ahead and move over to Africa now.
Oh, I just wanted to say one thing.
Shoot, man.
I'm, you know how we have the like bootstraps myth of like pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you can make it regardless of the situation. I think that applies in our military context as well, is that we can assume that we can go to a country and that they will just understand the way that like how to build a nation.
Yeah, see, right? It is goodwill. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And we don't know a thing about nation building, because we've never actually had to do it. Like we've been so far removed from our own nation building that we have this idea that like, oh, if we just
change these specific circumstances in this country, then they'll just get it somehow. And like, that is clearly not the case. Just like you said, like, if we're not leading with the diplomatic arm of, hey, what do you need? Let's get you what you need, and then we can start from there. But instead, it's just, hey, we always tell people, hey, this is what you need, or we're going to do this in your country and you're going to like it, you know? And like, and then we get pissed off when it doesn't work. And it's like, well, of course it didn't work, and it's not going to get anywhere. And I don't know. I just thought that that was like, it's just that translation of into our military policy of our own weird economic policy of everybody just has to figure it out. And we'll just throw money and people at the problem until they do.
But eventually they'll realize we're here to help and it'll be okay. It'll be okay. Yeah, it'll be okay until you redeploy, which means it's now okay for you, but it sure as hell isn't okay for them.
Exactly. Oh, it's just, it's nonsensical. It's not really strategic thinking, and it has nothing to do with actually helping the people in the places that we send people to die. But yeah, let's move on to Africa.
So I didn't make any specific notes about Africa stuff. How do you guys wanna do that part?
I mean, I just wanted to bring up the fact that, like, you did hint at, Danny, the fact that there is a kind of similar situation. It's always again of like, we're not asking people what they need or what they want help with. We're just telling people, hey, look, we're going to do this in your country, and we might make some concessions with our agreements with them, but really it's about imposing our will. And so I am concerned about, you know, what are the different ways that you think this is going to play out in Africa? And on top of the fact that China, with the Belt and Road Initiative, is making real headway in Africa, and like, how are our interests gonna really conflict?
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
Yeah, so there's so much to say there. I'm glad you brought up the China element. So, okay. When I did the overview and covered the Africa section, the highlights that I wanted to hit, you know, I've done a few articles recently on it, and there's so many deep directions, you know, that I could get lost in. But, you know, Africa worries me with the Biden administration for the same reason it worried me and it escalated so intensely for the Obama administration. And that is because a few reasons. One, it figures pretty prominently in the minds of certain people at the Pentagon, certain people in the Capitol, and definitely in a lot of these like defense analysis expert and also influential think tanks, because specifically for interventionist hawks, particularly like the liberal internationalist, liberal interventionist types, Africa as a continent, as I write, has been both like a petri dish, a proving ground, and kind of this like paradigm. In other words, it's a petri dish for the problems that they think they can solve, like you know, ungoverned spaces and you know, climate change and poverty and, you know, all these ethnic like issues and, you know, potential genocides. And oh my god, now like Sam Power is coming back into power, and like she's going to be in charge of what, USAID? Like, Jesus, she's going to have like genocide watchers everywhere. Like, she's going to arm her USAID people with rifles. And the thing is, it's not that genocide is not a real thing and that some of her academic work wasn't important, but the idea that intervention by the West is always the answer, especially when there's such a propensity to exaggerate and raise alarm about what's actually a genocide, right? But nevertheless, they see this as kind of, you know, so it's a petri dish for the problems, but it's a proving ground for the paradigm of the liberal polite interventionist, which is that you can use this abstraction, this low intensity tech savvy war of like drones, special operators, advisors, local proxies, and then clandestine intelligence missions, you know, you can use this to win wars and to like move policy and kind of, you know, change the facts on the ground. Now, it's failed time and again. It failed for 8 Obama years, and it failed even more mightily in many cases in 4 Trump years. However, they still believe it. So that's the first thing that bothers me. The second thing that worries me about Biden coming in is that the very things that he's most likely to be persuaded by, they all exist in Africa. So the first one is the stuff that I wrote about in antiwar.com this week, 2 days ago, which is that there's a lot of alarm raising coming from West Point, coming even from UK defense analysts, you know, organizations and defense studies departments in their, you know, military funded, otherwise, you know, masquerading as academia locales. Of course, in this case, it's defense, you know, spelled with a C because it's, you know, it's England, so it's more sophisticated. But nevertheless, you're seeing a lot of AFRICOM alarmism, like ISIS related, like, oh, ISIS is on the rise in Africa. And I deflate that pretty horribly and effectively, at least in the anti-war column. But it's something that I think he'll be susceptible to, this idea that, hey, ISIS is on the rise and ISIS is synonymous with evil. And so we might have to, like, you know, escalate a little bit. But it's great because it's Africa. So Africa doesn't even have a lot of soldiers. They don't have a lot of resources. They're like 1500 like permanently assigned people, you know, in uniform. So, hey, we'll test this theory a little more. But the really troubling one is what you brought up, which is China-Russia. Because in the 2018 National Security Strategy, GPC, great power competition, right? Great buzzword, great acronym, has been made the primary threat, right? The primary strategy and focus of the U.S. military. Of course, that's ridiculous, and it inflates those threats, and it ends up being aggressive and counterproductive. But nevertheless, it's going to stick around, and especially with like all of the Russia, Putin proxy and sort of like stooge stuff about Trump that was thrown around. You know, the Democrats have made everything about Russia for so long, and they're both trying to outhawk each other, the Democrats and Republicans, on China. And the fact that there's just enough of a kernel of truth to the fact that there's particularly Chinese influence, mostly economic, but there is one military base in Djibouti and I think another one coming, which is nothing compared to our, you know, kind of, you know, host of bases that have been exploding across Africa. But there's just enough truth that I'm afraid. And AFRICOM is savvy too, but they're PowerPoint savvy. They're really good at finding captains who write vaguely well, not for the earth, but for the military, to write these new strategies. And so what they've done to align and nest, right, all those like terms from the military to, you know, align their priorities with the broader national security statement, they've made their primary number one listed line of effort GPC, right? Great power competition. And they're going to point to particularly the Horn of Africa, because that's where China's one base is. And I'm afraid that we'll get pulled in there. And as for my predictions bit and how I've been a bit prescient recently, wouldn't you know that there was literally a headline, and I reposted on Twitter after someone else tagged me in it, that Emmanuel Macron of France, since their war in West Africa is falling apart, right? 5 French soldiers, KIA, in the first 5 days of, you know, the new year, and then maybe they hit it with another wedding, which is such a war on terror cliche, guys. You know, if you're going to massacre civilians, just don't do a wedding. You know, what about a christening? Why haven't we hit any christenings with our drones? You know what I mean? But I mean, I'm being wildly flippant dark here. But France's war is falling apart, failing by every single metric, every single one. And I said, hey, watch out. In my first article on Mali, I said, watch out. Be prepared that Macron and Biden could become chums. They kind of like each other despite the age gap. They both speak that like vague internationalist multilateral intervention language, right? They're sophisticates. They're urbane imperialists. But sure enough, there was a headline yesterday that in Macron's New Year's like talk to his troops, you know, it wasn't like on New Year's, I don't think, but he gave like this talk to the military. And he basically said like he's hoping Biden will basically help him out, you know, that Biden is going to have to infuse more troops, not just in Africa, but in the greater Middle East. And look, this is him asking for a bailout. He's the Goldman Sachs of failed African adventures asking for a bailout, right? And it's going to be like GM and all these people all over again. And he's probably going to give golden parachute bonuses to his failed generals. And it's going to be the same thing all over again. And I'm taking this analogy far, but I feel really good about it. But the point is, I'm really worried about Africa for all those reasons.
Do you think there's a way that we can like push the Well, I'm hoping that there are people in the State Department who are finally like, okay, we need to stop being the military or the like diplomatic arm of the DOD and start actually doing our jobs. And I hope that that means that there will be people who will then like try to listen to what the countries in Africa want and like what they need. And then maybe like we can temper at least somewhat our like footprint militarily with some actual diplomatic like help. So I don't know, but I don't see that happening.
No. Well, you know, here's the thing. I think that there are FAOs, foreign area officers, who like, you know, they kind of work with, I think they fall under DIA, and they do work with state largely because they're in the embassies and all that. And then of course, within the recesses of Foggy Bottom, right? The actual mid-level experts who get, you know, like Milton, they get thrown into the basement and they get their red stapler taken from them. You know, there's plenty of professional bureaucrats, both in the military and especially in the State Department, who specialize their entire careers on Africa because they are geeks and because they love it. And in many cases, because they actually care about Africans to some extent. And they've been yelling about this, that like, hey, militarizing AFRICOM is a big mistake and this is like counterproductive. But that's the whole point. They get treated like Milton because the political appointees come in and the combat arms officers who actually run things like AFRICOM and make the decisions, right? And they have a lot in common in certain sense with the political appointees because they don't have expertise. They have leadership and charisma, meaning sociopathy largely. But the thing is, no one listens to the experts. And it has always been thus. And I study Africa a lot under the Reagan and even the tail end of the Carter administration and all our proxy wars during that era, usually surrounding supporting apartheid, by the way. And one of the things you note is that when you read these long-ass books on it, they constantly quote the mid-level guys in the State Department who were like, no, this is a terrible idea. We're so opposed to this, but they don't get listened to. And I just don't think that Biden's political appointees really much care for nuance and complexity. And they are thinking big. And they take pride in their big thinking. And they don't like details. And they don't like splitting. What they like is lumping. But lumping problems together and vaguely generalizing and missing the nuance, that has always been a forever war formula. And nowhere has that been more tragic in many cases in the long run than in Africa since forever.
So for Yemen, just in the in the last couple of weeks, Mike Pompeo has been able to designate the Houthis as a terrorist organization, which until that designation changes, which incoming Biden execs are saying that they will review it. It wasn't saying specifically that it will be changed, but that will make it a lot harder for humanitarian aid to get in the country, which of course is exacerbating an already horrific situation. Our participation there, providing refueling and intelligence sharing, has allowed Saudi Arabia and their partners in Yemen with the UAE to continue bombing the hell out of anything that they can. It's still considered the world's largest cholera outbreak. And you know, my big thought about it is that, you know, why is this horribly, horribly awful humanitarian disaster, separate from the war part of it, not being dealt with on a bigger level? So I would hope and pray that Biden does a lot. I don't know that he will do a lot, but certainly they will probably have to do something, because the situation just has become that unhinged, that untenable on a humanitarian level. What do you think about that, Danny?
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
Well, first of all, I mean, the Trump decision to, you know, label the Houthis like, you know, the terrorist, you know, it also is really about Iran, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, Yemen, in Iraq, we've put ourselves in the role of proxies. And don't get me wrong, like, we also create death and destruction for Iraqis as a, you know, as a function of that. But, you know, in Yemen is the great crime of, in many cases, of the second half of the war on terror. And because its ramifications on victims have been so very overt and so very fast and so very quickly overt and so very quickly just been horrifying and specifically focused on civilians, I can't help but wonder if in the end it will be Yemen that is the stain, the ultimate primary stain on the on our entire generation of Americans. I mean, and it ought to be, by the way. It'll be competing with Iraq and the Civil War. But I mean, Yemen is another one of those places, just like I mentioned in Africa, where there is a substitution of vague generalities and strategic buzzwording and alarmist threats for nuance and complexity. I mean, there are some really smart people that Biden has appointed to top positions in terms of just their raw intelligence. Jake Sullivan is a brilliant guy, but he's probably one of the brightest of the bunch in terms of like what he knows, because he is a reader and he is a geek, you know. And I think that part of it, by the way, I have an obsession with him, as you know, he is my blind spot. You know, he's taking over Mike Pompeo's old role as my nemesis. But he, you know, I think that he maybe substitutes some of his like tough guy hawkishness for the fact that he's really a geek and he's afraid to just let himself be one. But that's probably his best side if he didn't use it for evil. But the thing is, even the smartest of the bunch on these issues, I mean, could not hold their own in a discussion on the basic contours of what's really happening in Yemen, what that conflict's really about on the ground. I mean, in terms of like Houthis and, you know, AQ in the, you know, Arabian Peninsula. Yeah, ACAP, right? Yeah, who you probably know a bunch about, I imagine. And I'd be interested to know your thoughts on Yemen specifically, actually, Kagan. You know, they don't understand this conflict. They can't explain it particularly well. And I mean, Jake Sullivan could probably make everyone else look stupid who doesn't know anything about Yemen. But I could name 10 people who could make him look very stupid on this issue. And of course, and this is the Biden bunch that's brighter than your average bears. But what gets missed in that lumping, in that vague generalities, is that the reality is the Houthis have never been all that tied to Iran, for example. And that... No. The Houthis have never, despite yelling down with America and all those things, some of that is sloganeering because that was driven largely by America's obscene role in the greater Middle East and negative effects on the Shia peoples therein, and was really heightened when their children started getting bombed and starved to death inside the blockade that could have only happened if America greenlighted and then supported it. Directly.
If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode, please visit our website at www.fortressonahill.com. We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill, facebook.com/FortressOnAHill, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify, and now KBOO.FM. You name it, just about anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
Personality. What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality. Your personality is the way you affect other people. Think about that. The way you affect other people. Another part of personality is the way other people affect you. And if other people have a bad effect on you, you feel pretty strange. You might even feel uncomfortable.
Cable Community Radio is hiring for a development director. Our development director oversees KBOO's fundraising, donor and business outreach, and leads the development team with light supervisory duties. Our ideal candidate has at least 4 years of proven development experience in the nonprofit sector, preferably with significant